turning in our Bibles tonight to Judges chapter 15, please. Reading at verse 1 and reading down to the end of the chapter. Our overall theme these past Tuesday nights has been hearts of iron, feet of clay. And that's what we have discovered. These judges, these deliverers raised up by God in a dark day in Israel's history to be. As we're going to see next Tuesday evening especially, Samson was a man with a heart of iron and yet feet of clay. We've been looking at Samson this last two Tuesday evenings, and we've come to our 12th study tonight, and we're going to look at God's freedom fighter. Judges chapter 15 and verse 1. But it came to pass, within a while after, in the time of wheat harvest, that Samson visited his wife with a kid. It would just be like you on Valentine's Day coming to your wife with a bunch of flowers. You know, of course, that it's Friday, so don't forget. Or with a box of Thornton chocolates. He's just coming down to his wife with a kid, with a young goat. You see, the marriage has never been consummated. And so he thinks it's time to make up with the wife. And so in verse 1 it says, Samson visited his wife with a kid, and he said, I will go into my wife into the chamber. But her father would not suffer him to go in. And her father said, I verily thought that thou hadst utterly hated her. Therefore I give her to thy companion. Is not her younger sister fairer than she? Take her, I pray thee, instead of her. And Samson said concerning them, Now shall I be more blameless than the Philistines, though I do them a displeasure. And Samson went and caught 300 foxes, and took firebrands and turned tail to tail, and put a firebrand in the midst between two tails. And when he had set the brands on fire, he let them go into the standing corn of the Philistines, and burnt up both the shocks and also the standing corn with the vineyards and olives. Then the Philistines said, Who hath done this? And they answered, Samson, the son-in-law of the Timnite, because he had taken his wife and given her to his companion. And the Philistines come up and burnt her and her father with fire. Then, and Samson said unto them, Though ye have done this, yet will I be avenged of you, and after that I will cease. And he smote them hip and thigh with a great slaughter, and he went down and dwelt in the top of the rock Etam. Then the Philistines went up and pitched in Judah, and spread themselves in Leah. And the men of Judah said, Why are ye come up against us? And they answered, To bind Samson are we come up, to do to him as he hath done to us. Then 3,000 men of Judah went to the top of the rock Etam, and said to Samson, Knowest thou not that the Philistines are rulers over us? What is this that thou hast done unto us? And he said unto them, As they did unto me, so have I done unto them. And they said unto him, We are come down to bind thee, that we may deliver thee into the hand of the Philistines. That's the state of the people of God in Israel. They are ready to deliver Samson up to the enemy. And Samson said unto them, Swear unto me, that ye will not fall upon me yourselves. And they speak unto him, saying, No, but we will bind thee fast and deliver thee into their hand, but surely we will not kill thee. And they bound him with two new cords and brought him up from the rock. And when he came unto Leah, the Philistines shouted against him. And the Spirit of the Lord came mightily upon him. And the cords that were upon his arms became as flax that was burnt with fire, and his bands loosed from off his hands, and he found a new jawbone of an ox or of an ass, and put forth his hand and took it, and slew 1,000 men therewith. Samson said, With the jawbone of an ass, heaps upon heaps, with the jawbone of an ass have I slain 1,000 men. And it came to pass when he had made an end of speaking that he cast away the jawbone out of his hand and called that place Ramath Lehi. And he was sore athirst and called on the Lord and said, Thou hast given this great deliverance into thy hand of thy servant. And now shall I die for thirst and fall into the hand of the uncircumcised. But God clave an hollow place that was in the jaw. And there came water thereout, and when he had drunk, his spirit came again. And he revived, wherefore he called the name thereof En Hakkore, which is Leah, unto this day. Now here's an important phrase. And he, Samson, judged Israel in the days of the Philistines 20 years. It's as almost as if the Holy Spirit is saying there in the last verse, that was the end of Samson's life. Of course, we know it's not, because we're going to see him toying with temptation next Tuesday evening. But it's as almost as if the Holy Spirit is saying, all that Samson has done worthwhile is now done, period, full stop. We're going to look at chapter 16 next week. Our subject tonight is God's freedom fighter. If you can cast your mind back to the spring of 1977, a television program and a book triggered a social phenomenon. Everyone was talking about Alex Haley's roots, and a record 80 million people in the United States of America set aside other things to watch the final episode of that series. That was only the beginning. The publisher's race to keep an adequate supply of books on the shelves, magazine articles abounded, and people of all ethnic origins began to look out and seek out and discover their own roots. One major magazine in the United States of America called Roots a potentially important benchmark in United States race relations. Roots begins with the story of an African named Kunta Kinte. In the 18th century, at the age of 17, he was taken from his home in Mandeka in Africa, and he was shipped under the most degrading conditions to a life of slavery and bondage in the state of Virginia. But Kunta was a man with a passion for freedom. And after months in chains, with his health broken, he was released for only a moment. And instantly he tried to escape. Dogs hunted him down. And when he was recaptured, he was first beaten and then chained, and he hobbled about for months on end. All around him, in the state of Virginia, Kunta saw other colored people, broken in health, defeated by slavery, having given in to the hopelessness and the helplessness of their condition. Kunta refused to give up hope. Finally, the day came when his hobbles were taken off, and he ran away again. He couldn't go as fast this time because he had an infected ankle, and he was quickly recaptured, but he refused to give up. One day he stole a weapon, and again he fled. It was snowing. He was quickly hunted down. His tracks were visible in the snow. He was bound and whipped and returned to a life in shackles. By this time, the other colored slaves in the camp wanted nothing to do with him. They treated him as if he was some kind of wild animal, and Kunta simply couldn't understand them. How could they be at peace with the white man when they were the white man's slaves? Death would be so much better than slavery. And so he tried to escape one more time. This time, he planned his escape very carefully. And when an opportunity came, he hid in a wagon and he rode off to freedom. This time he was hunted down by a pair of ruthless slave catchers who, when they got him, cut off most of his foot with an axe. Kunta could no longer run, but still in his heart there was that passion for freedom. His great desire, His burning ambition was to live and to die a free man. Samson was a man who had many flaws in his life, but he had one tremendous virtue. He was a man with a passion for freedom in the midst of a society committed to compromise. With all his failure, he was the only man of his day to recognize that there can be no compromise with the enemy. You see, the Jews around him were committed to appeasement. They were committed to appeasement with their lords, their overlords, their enemy, the Philistines. But Samson was committed to be God's freedom fighter. Not that long ago, there was a news story about 300 whales who were marooned on a beach. Scientists could only explain the mystery by speculating that the whales had been chasing sardines and they had been trapped in the shallow water when the tide had gone out. For most of his life, Samson was like a whale chasing sardines, a great power pursuing small goals. He was finally beached by the pursuit of the sardine of sexual pleasure. But here, in chapter 15, we see Samson at his best. Next week, in chapter 16, we're going to see Samson at his worst. Here in chapter 15, we see Samson. We see him at his spiritual pinnacle, except for the time of his death. Here we see the tremendous power of a man who trusted God. And we realize how much he could have accomplished for God if only he had lived consistently. Now, chapter 15 divides neatly into three sections. Have a look at them and I'll outline them for you. First of all, in verses 1, right down to verse 8, we have personal revenge. Samson bringing about his revenge, his vengeance upon the Philistines. And then from verse 9 right down to verse 17, we have national relapse. A nation who are committed to compromise with the Philistines. And then in verses 18 through 20, we have spiritual renewal. The passion to get even seemed to govern Samson's life. His motto was, "As they did to me," verse 11, "so have I done to them." This episode began when Samson discovered that he had been the victim of terrible injustice. And Samson was not the kind of guy who turned to you the other cheek. Look at the steps that led to his personal revenge. There was the action that was unrestrained. The action that was unrestrained. You remember chapter 14? Flick back to it for a moment or two. Chapter 14, you remember, is all about going down. It is both perilous and ominous when a Christian starts going down. Look at chapter 14, verse 1. "And Samson went down to Timnah." Verse 5. "Then went Samson down." Verse 7. "And he went down." Verse 10. "So his father went down." It's all about going down. His action was unrestrained. You see, Samson's walk was unrestrained. As we noticed last Tuesday evening, his compromise began with the unequal yoke in marriage. His parents never saw another happy day in their experience after that day when he came up to his hometown of Zorah. And he said concerning the Philistine woman, "Get her for me to wife." Samson went down to marry one woman, but now he finds he has 30 Philistine companions, 30 Philistines for his companions. Look at verse 11 of chapter 14. "And it came to pass when they saw him that they brought 30 companions to be with him." He married one. He has ended up with 30. He's linked to one. But that one has grown to 30. Many years ago, an old country preacher said this. Listen to it. Sin will take you further than you want to go. Sin will cost you more than you want to pay. Sin will keep you longer than you want to stay. Have you ever heard believers saying, but I'm only going to compromise on one point. I'm only going to adopt one principle that is not scriptural. And so often that has become the thin edge of the wedge. Samson's walk was unrestrained. And then Samson's talk was unrestrained. He's always telling his secrets. He's always anxious to talk about things that no one else ought to know but himself. You remember the proposal that he wagered with the Philistines. We're going to see him next week in the arms of his Delilah, divulging the secret of his strength. Hardly the conversation, the talk of a man who's under the influence and control of the Spirit of God. His action was unrestrained. Look at chapter 15 and verse 1. Notice not only the action that was unrestrained, but the affair that was unfulfilled. It came to pass within a while that in the time of wheat harvest that Samson visited his wife with a kid. And he said, I will go into my wife, into the chamber, but her father would not suffer him to go in. You can picture the scene. It's a lovely day in the month of May and there's a knock on the door. And there stands Samson with a young goat in lieu of flowers. He's got the young goat under his arm. He's got a twinkle in his eye. You see, he thinks it's time to make up with the wife. He still wants the Philistine girl. What he didn't realize was this. That it was a terrible disgrace for the marriage never to be consummated. And so the bride had been given to the best man. And when Samson arrives down to Timnath, the shocking truth hits him. No, Samson could not consummate the marriage. Yes, they might be pagans, but even the Philistines of some standards. And so his father-in-law had his daughter married off to his best man. My friends, if Samson was angry before, he was furious now. And he was determined to attack the Philistines who had pressured the girl to turn her betrothal into a betrayal. A whole can of worms, or should we say, a whole can of foxes was about to be opened. Don't miss the steps that led to his personal revenge. There was the anger that was, there was the action that was unrestrained, the affair that was unfulfilled, and now the anger that was uncontrolled. Now let me pause. Remember, the Bible teaches us that there is a righteous anger and a sinful anger. You remember what Paul says to the church at Ephesus? He says, be ye angry and sin not. If we would be angry and not sin, we must be angry at nothing but sin. Did you get that? If we would be angry and not sin, we must be angry at nothing but sin. You see, do you see what Samson does here? Rather than focusing on the immediate problem of his wife that has been stolen, he attacks the real enemy. You see, it wasn't the girl who had caused the problem. It wasn't his father-in-law who had caused the problem. It was the Philistines who had blackmailed his girl, his wife, his new bride, into betraying him. And Samson turns upon them in all of his fury, and he hits them where it hurts, in the stomach. Somehow Samson captured 300 foxes. The Hebrew word can mean foxes or jackals. And since jackals run in pairs, it may have been jackals that was the animal here. And he tied those jackals or those foxes in pairs, and he put a torch. He put a torch between their tails, and he set them loose in the middle of the Philistines' standing corn. Now remember, the Philistines were an agricultural people. They were a farming community. And their livelihood and supply for an entire year for an entire 10-12 months depended on the grain harvest. No doubt they experienced some disillusionment, since Dagon was their god, and he was the god of grain, and the god of Philistia was unable to prevent this catastrophe. My dear friends, if Samson wanted to stir up the Philistines, he succeeded. For when their harvest went up in flames, they were so livid that they went up to Timnath and they burned alive his wife and his father-in-law. Now, while Samson's actions weakened the Philistines, his motives to me appear to be personal. Satisfying his own sensual desires, avenging his own injuries, personal revenge. My friends, personal revenge and private gain rather than the glory of the Lord has motivated more than one crusader in the Church of Jesus Christ. What some people think is godly zeal may actually be ungodly anger fed by pride and motivated by selfishness. Personal revenge. I wonder, are you guilty of that? Anger is a real problem. A great American statesman by the name of Thomas Jefferson worked out a way to handle his anger. He included it in his rules of living, which describes how he believed adult men and adult women should live. He wrote this: when angry, count 10 before you speak. If very angry, count 100. Author Mark Twain, 75 years later, revised Jefferson's rules, and he wrote this: when angry, count 4. When very angry, swear. There's a righteous anger. We're thinking about a sinful anger. You see, when we turn to the New Testament, and let me just approach this from a New Testament point of view. When we turn to the New Testament, we discover three things about sinful anger. Here's the first thing. It displeases the Spirit of God. Let's flick over to the book of Ephesians just quickly. The book of Ephesians, chapter 4. And reading at verse 30, please. Ephesians, chapter 4, and verse 30. Sinful anger does three things, at least. Here's the first thing it does. It displeases the Spirit of God. Look at verse 30. Paul says, and grieve not the Holy Spirit of God, whereby you're sealed unto the day of redemption. Well, how do we grieve the Spirit of God? Well, the answer's in the context. Look at verse 28. We grieve the Spirit of God by stealing. Let him that stole steal no more. But rather, let him labor, working with his hands the things which is good. We grieve the Spirit of God by stealing. We grieve the Spirit of God by impurity. Verse 29, let no corrupt communication proceed out of your mouth, but that which is good to the use of edifying, that it may minister grace unto the hearers. We grieve the Spirit of God by stealing, by impurity. We grieve the Spirit of God by anger. Verse 31, let all bitterness and wrath and anger and clamor and evil speaking be put away from you with all malice, and be ye kind one to another, tender hearted, forgiving one another, even as God for Christ's sake hath forgiven you. Do you realize, my dear friend, that when you exhibit your bad temper, you're grieving the Spirit of God? Do you realize that when you stamp your feet, when you walk out on someone, when you sulk, you're grieving the Spirit of God? Do you realize that when you nurse those grudges and hold those grievances against someone for weeks and months and years, you're grieving the Spirit of God? It displeases the Spirit of God. Sinful anger does something else. It not only displeases the Spirit of God, but it divides the people of God. You remember what the book of Hebrews says, follow peace with all men and holiness without which no man shall see the Lord. As believers, we have the responsibility to keep the unity of the Spirit in the bond of peace. You say, what disrupts that unity? Bitterness. Anger. My friends, bitterness has divided many human families. You remember Esau and Jacob? How sure you know that bitterness divides human families. When it comes to the reading of the will and the making of the will, sure many a family has been torn in two, and families are divided this very evening because of the way wills have been left and bitterness has come in. But listen, bitterness not only divides the natural physical family, it divides the spiritual family, the family of God. One Christian has got a grudge against another. One of the elders in the Iron Hall used to talk to me about Christians in the meeting who had got a twist on. Do you know what that is? They've got a chip on their shoulder. They've got a grudge. Hardly speak to you at the door. Shake your hand. They've got a twist on. And they're holding a grudge against some believer in the fellowship. And that bitterness not only affects the Christian who holds it, and it not only affects the Christian against whom it is held, it disrupts the whole fellowship. For you see, the believer who's got the grudge, he never keeps it to himself. He talks about it. He talks about it behind someone else's back. You see, he hasn't got the courage to go and face his brother or sister in Christ. And my dear friends, the whole assembly is defiled. That's what bitterness does. Sure, we know it does that. We have seen it in our families. We have seen it in our churches. It displeases the Spirit of God. It divides the people of God. But something else, sinful anger disrupts the worship of God. You remember what the Lord Jesus said, "If thou bring thy gift to the altar, and there rememberest that thy brother hath ought against thee, leave there thy gift before the altar, and go thy way. First be reconciled to thy brother, and then come and offer thy gift." If I, in the presence of God, and while seeking to worship God, know in my heart that I am not right with my brother, my sister in Christ, then my worship is valueless, it's worthless. And the mission had commenced, and there seemed to be little power in the meetings. No conversions, no move. One day Moody said that perhaps there was some Christian who was in the fellowship, who was harboring an unforgiving spirit. And immediately he said that, the chairman of the committee who was running the mission got up. And he left the meeting. The arrow had hit the mark and had gone home. And this chairman had a trouble with some believer in the meeting for 6 months. And he hunted this man up and he asked him for his forgiveness. That night after D.L. Moody preached, the inquiry room was thronged. Is it not time you flushed out that old anger out of your heart? Is it not time that that heart of yours was flushed out? That you got rid of the bitterness and the anger and the malice and the grievance and the twist, and you put it right with your brother? And you put it right with God. Personal revenge. Come back to Samson. The second thing I want you to notice here is national relapse. You see, the Philistines realized that the only way to deal with this problem with Samson was to discover him, detect him, and destroy him. And so they approached Leah in the vicinity of Zorah to conquer this one-man army once and for all. Now, it's interesting that when the Philistines come up to capture Samson, they had no quarrel with the rest of the Israelites. When they come up to take Samson, they had no resistance from the rest of the Israelites. We're not sure how many came up, but what we do know is that Samson killed 1,000 of them. And Judah raised a force of 3,000 to deal with Samson. And so we could maybe guess tonight. I think it would be safe to assume that coming up to Leah, there were 3,000 to 5,000 Philistines who come up to deal with one man. Imagine that. Imagine about 4,000 Philistines come up to capture one bloke. I don't know how many go to football matches now. Would Glenavon get 4,000? Billy says if you count their legs. No, if you count their toes. I don't know how. But imagine 4,000. 4,000. Approximately. Coming up to deal with one man. Now perhaps the most striking thing about this passage is that it reveals to us the spiritual condition of God's people. Look at verse 10. And the men of Judah said, "Why are ye come up against us?" And they answered, "To bind Samson are we come up, to do to him as he hath done to us." Now look at this verse. Then 3,000 men of Judah went to the top of the rock Etam and said to Samson, "Do you not know, knowest thou not that the Philistines are rulers over us? And what is this that thou hast done unto us?" And he said unto them, "As they did unto me, so have I done unto them." When the Philistines come up to destroy Samson, not only did the Israelites not protect him, but they sent a force of 3,000 men to bring him down to his death. Isn't that sad? You see what happened? The Israelites had so compromised their personal identity that they would rather hand over Samson than upset the Philistine. Now let's analyze that a little closer. Look at the men that are specified, verse 10. And the men of Judah said. Now that's important. Perhaps a Judahite person, spokesman, appeared on Philistine television about to read a statement about how outraged they were, how the Judeans were outraged over the irresponsible and inexcusable behavior of Samson the Danite. You see, the men of Judah didn't look upon Samson as their deliverer. They looked upon Samson as a troublemaker. Now, Judah was no ordinary tribe. You remember what was said of Judah way back in the book of Genesis? Come back for a moment to Genesis 49. Judah was no ordinary tribe. Look at what old Jacob says when he's blessing the tribes at his death. Here's what he says. Genesis chapter 49, please, in verse 8. Genesis 49 and verse 8. Jacob's on his deathbed. And he's gathered together his sons and he's blessing them. Verse 8 says, "Judah, thou art he whom thy brethren shall praise. Thy hand shall be upon the neck of thine enemies. Thy father's children shall bow down before thee. Judah is a lion's whelp. From the prey, my son, thou art gone up." He stooped down. He couched as a lion, and as an old lion, who shall rouse him up? The scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor a lawgiver from between his feet, until Shiloh come, and unto him shall the gathering of the people be. Judah was prominent. You know, when they were marching through the Israel, when they were marching through the wilderness, Judah went first. When Moses did his census, Judah was the tribe that had the largest possible number. But you know, Judah didn't live up to the dignity of which Jacob spoke. Indeed, time and time again, Judah failed. You remember in the days of Nehemiah, when they were building the walls, they had a mind to work, they had a heart to pray, they had an eye to watch. And you remember Nehemiah was encountering opposition, and there was opposition from without, and there was discouragement from within. It was Judah who said, it was the men of Judah who said, "The strength of the bearers is decayed. There's much rubbish. We're not able to build. My dear friends, here in the time of Samson, here's the cream of the nation. Here's the very people that Samson thought he could depend upon. Ready to deliver them up. Is that not so true to Christian experience? I was thinking just the other day when I was preparing this, how many a pastor, evangelist, servant of God has been betrayed by the very people whom he thought he could trust. Judah. Come back to Judges 15. Notice not only the men that are specified. I want you to see the marks here that are identified, for we can identify the marks of spiritual relapse here in the nation. All the consequences of spiritual compromise are found as we look at Judah's attitude to the Philistines in relation to Samson. Let me give you three marks here. One, Israel were living with the enemy. Look at verse 11. Samson, knowest thou not that the Philistines are rulers over us? What is this that thou hast done unto us? Isn't that sad? Is it possible, dear friends, that we have sunk to the level where we prefer slavery rather than freedom? Wonder, have we accommodated ourselves so much to the world's lifestyle and the presence of sin in our lives that we just accept them, accept those sins, and we give up the fight? You see, that's where Israel were. They had become satisfied with the status quo. They couldn't imagine why the Philistines had any quarrel with them. And they were filled with tremendous anger because Samson had rocked the boat. You know something? When you're living with the enemy as a Christian, you'll have no time for the committed. Did you know that? When you're living with the enemy as a child of God, you'll have no time for the committed Christian. Samson was an embarrassment to Judah. And they would rather see him dead at the hands of the Philistines than change their lifestyle. It's a sad fact of Christian experience that if you're a Christian committed to maturing and growing in Christ, you'll often be hindered most by Christians who have become accustomed to an anemic, wishy-washy Christian life. Israel were living with the enemy. The second mark here that I want you to notice of compromise is this: Israel were ignored by the enemy. My friends, the Philistines had no quarrel with Israel. Why? Because they represented no threat. Satan lost no sleep over Judah. You see, it's only when we begin to serve God wholeheartedly, it's only when we get out to the front line of the battle, that Satan works to sidetrack you. Wonder tonight, as a Christian, are you encountering opposition? Well, thank God you are. For it shows that you're making Satan sit up and take notice. Man came to a preacher on one occasion with the comment. He said, "What's all this talk about Satan? I've never met Satan in all of my life." And quick as a flash, the answer came back, "Of course not. You'll never meet someone when you're going in the same direction as he is. But if you turn around and start going the other direction and live wholeheartedly for God, you'll meet him soon enough." Compromise number one, Israel were living with the enemy. Compromise number two, Israel were ignored by the enemy. Compromise number three, Israel were working for the enemy. Did you notice that in verse 12? "And they said unto Samson, we are come down to bind thee, that we may deliver thee into the hand of the Philistines. And Samson said unto them, swear unto me that ye will not fall upon me yourselves." Can you credit it? The men of Judah, the cream of the nation, they were fighting the Philistine battles. You see, there are no non-combatants in spiritual warfare. There is no Switzerland where we can sit out the battle in neutrality. If we're not actively involved in a positive way for Christ, we can become positive hindrances to the cause of Christ. All the marks of compromise were here, living with the enemy, ignored by the enemy, working for the enemy. Isn't it lovely in contrast to all of that to notice the man that's fortified? You see, in complete contrast to the compromise of Judah, we see the courage of Samson. My dear friends, on this day, how his faith was shining brightly. You know what it says of Samson in Hebrews chapter 11? Mind you, he's in the catalogue of... Oh, I know, next week we're going to see him in the arms of his Delilah. But he's in Hebrews chapter 11. You know what it says? By faith, Samson. Through faith, Samson. Do you notice faith give him? Give him two things. It give him serenity in the face of betrayal. Serenity in the face of betrayal. He had every right to be furious with those traitors. But while he could have retaliated against the Israelites, he revealed that he had their best interests at heart. It was a great moment in Samson's life when he dealt so kindly with the people who had been treating him so badly. His faith gave him serenity in the face of betrayal, but it gave him something else. It gave him victory in the face of defeat. John says, and this is the victory that overcometh even our faith. Who can question that it was only Samson's faith that produced this tremendous courage in an hour of crisis and gave him victory in the face of defeat? Faith, mighty faith, the promise sees, laughs at impossibilities and cries, it shall be done. Can you see this Hercules of a man? And he's snapping the ropes like thread as he picks up that jawbone that's still fresh, that's got all its teeth in its place. And in the hand of Samson, it becomes a terrible weapon. And at the end of the battle, 1,000 lying dead. Do you see what Samson could do? Do you see what Samson could be when he trusted God? My friends, do you see what you can do? Can you see what you can be when you trust God? Compromise always spells defeat, but faith always spells victory. National relapse. That brings us to the last few verses. Have a look at them. Spiritual renewal. For in his hour of triumph, Samson uttered a prayer to God. Now, that's the only prayer recorded in his life. Prior, of course, to his death prayer. This was a spiritual high point in Samson's life, as he cries out to God after the victory. Look at the prayer that was directed to God. Verse 18. And he was sore athirst and called on the Lord and said, Thou hast given this great deliverance into the hand of thy servant. And now shall I die for thirst and fall into the hand of the uncircumcised. You see what Samson was conscious of. He was conscious that his victory was due to God. He was conscious that he was God's servant. And he was conscious that he was called to deal with the enemy. You know something? Our calling affects our conduct. Our calling affects our conduct. This was one great occasion in the life of Samson when he was conscious of living up to his calling. When Queen Victoria was a little girl, she was shielded from the fact that one day she was going to be queen. She was being trained all along for the position, but they just kept shielding her from this fact. There was a fear within the hearts of those who were training her that knowledge would spoil her. And because, of course, she didn't know her calling in life, she didn't take her training very seriously. And so one day her teachers decided that it was necessary to let her discover her future position. Her immediate response was this: from now on, I will be good. her conduct was controlled by her calling. Is yours? I want you to see that not only our conduct or our calling affects our conduct, but I want you to see something else in verse 18. Our victory makes us vulnerable. That's simple, isn't it? Our victory makes us vulnerable. Notice what he said. Now shall I die for thirst and fall into the hand of the uncircumcised. That's an amazing cry, isn't it? It's an amazing cry from a man who's just walked into the horde of the Philistines courageously. And he's taken them on and he's just slain 1,000 of them with the jawbone of an ass. And now this same man is terrified of dying by thirst. But then Samson's experience is not unique. Sure it's not. You remember Elijah? Turn quickly to this in closing. Look at this. 1 Kings for a moment. 1 Kings. The first book of Kings. Chapter 19. Very quickly. Chapter 19. 1 Kings chapter 19. Our calling affects our conduct. Our victory makes us vulnerable. Look at 1 Kings chapter 19. And Ahab told Jezebel all that Elijah had done, and with all how he had slain all the prophets with the sword. Then Jezebel sent a messenger unto Elijah, saying, so let the gods do to me, and more also, if I might make not thy life as the life of one of them by tomorrow about this time. And when he saw that, he arose and went for his life and came to Beersheba. He has come from Jezreel. He's come from Carmel. Some of you have been on Mount Carmel. He's ran to Jezreel. He's come right down the Jordan Valley. It's a distance of 90 or 100 miles. He's not doing it on an air-conditioned coach. He's doing it by himself, which belongeth to Judah, and left his servant there. Verse 4, but he himself went a day's journey into the wilderness and came and sat down under a juniper tree. And he requested for himself that he might die. Can you credit it? He says, it's enough. Now, O Lord, take away my life. I am not better than my father. He's just come from Carmel, the mountain of victory. Now he's in the valley of depression. I want to tell you tonight, it's a short distance from the pinnacle to the pits. It's a short distance from the mountain peak of excitement to the valley of despondency. It is. You see, there's something about victory that makes us vulnerable. You know that. You fellas that play sport, when are you most vulnerable? When you score. There's something about victory that takes your eye off the Lord and makes you vulnerable. Do you know what we tend to forget? We tend to forget that we're whole people. That there's a close connection between our physical and spiritual condition. You know, Samson didn't need a Bible conference. Samson didn't need an all-night prayer meeting. And I'm not against them. But he needed physical refreshment. Dr. Lewis Schaefer, founder of Dallas Theological Seminary, says, we should not mistake worn nerves, physical weakness, or depression for unspirituality. Many times sleep is needed more than prayer and physical recreation, than heart searching. Do you realize tonight that your physical exhaustion may upset your spiritual walk with God? The prayer that was directed to God. Come back to Judges 15 as we close. Look at the provision that was effected by God. What a practical God we have. But God clave an hollow place that was in the jaw, and there came water thereout. And when he had drunk, his spirit came again, and he revived. What a practical God we have. I'm glad, my dear friends, that we have a God who's concerned with our physical needs as well as our spiritual needs. Samson needed refreshment. God gave it. Elijah needed refreshment. God gave it. Elijah needed sustenance. God gave it. Elijah needed sleep. God gave it. I'm glad tonight that God not only provides for us spiritually, but He provides for His physically. Look at the last phrase. And He judged Israel in the days of the Philistines, 20 years. Now, between chapters 15 and 16, there's a gap of 20 years. And during that time, Samson led Israel and he led his people in a limited way. My friend, Samson had some tremendous shortcomings. We're going to see one of them next Tuesday night. But let's never forget that Samson stood alone for God in Israel. In a nation that was committed to the status quo, Samson was committed to freedom under God. And because he dared to trust God, God was able to use him. Do you have that passion for God's victory in your life, through your life? Like Samson tonight, are you prepared to challenge the status quo and trust in God? May God bless His Word to our hearts this evening.